This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 5th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Professional Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm going to be looking at a few things that developed in the past week regarding federal taxes. This week, we're going to have four things we're going to look at: a question involving an add-on battery to a solar energy unit and whether that could qualify for a solar energy credit. We looked at a disagreement between two courts on how to treat a particular pair of treaties. We also are going to find the IRS delivered on a couple of promises this week. The IRS issued the promise guidance on the attempt to lock out the way of using S corporations to try to get around the carried interest rules that were passed as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that was promised by the Treasury Secretary. And we also got the revised Form W-4 calculator and Form W-4 itself to deal with TCJA changes. We'll talk about that as what went on this week. But to get started, let's take a look at that battery issue. This comes to us as Private Letter Ruling 2018-09-003. It was issued on March the 2nd. In this particular case, we have a taxpayer that had previously installed a solar energy equipment in their home, and they had previously taken a credit for that equipment. Now, later on, you know, they're considering adding a storage battery to the system. The concept being that, you know, the sun doesn't shine 24/7, and sometimes you have cloud cover. There are various reasons why the solar energy system may not work super efficiently. But there are times when it works very efficiently, but we don't need the power at that point. So the idea is we'd like to put this battery system in place so that when the energy is created, any energy we don't need at that instant will be taken over to the battery until we fill the battery. Then when the solar energy system is no longer producing the amount of power that we need to run our house, we would then start drawing on the current in the battery and use the battery to charge up, you know, to make use of the energy in our house. The idea being conceptually to be able to use as much of the solar power as we could. Now, they want to add this battery. It wasn't part of the original system, but they're looking at adding it on in a later year. Now, the question became, well, can that really qualify for a Section 25D energy credit for solar energy equipment? Because this isn't really generating solar energy, right? It's storing it, but it's not really generating solar energy. And the credits for things that generate the energy. So the question became, could this addition to the system be deemed as part of the generation system? And could we treat it as creditable expenditure? And the IRS decided that that was possible. One key issue to understand, though, is, and one of the facts that the taxpayer asking for this ruling gave, and by the way, almost certainly the taxpayer asking for this ruling is not really just some little individual out there that's trying to put a battery on an existing solar energy unit. It almost certainly is a major supplier of these household batteries that is looking to get this ruling in order to be able to tell people that you can qualify for an energy credit if you purchase this battery to add to your existing solar energy system, because they've made a lot of advances in these whole house batteries in recent years. So the idea being, yeah, we know you already have a solar energy system. We're not asking you to go replace the whole thing. We just want you to add this battery, and this battery will give you this big credit. One of the key things that was important here, though, was that the system was designed, and there's a lot of detail in the ruling about how the system was designed. But it was designed specifically to assure the only charge to the battery would ever come from the solar energy unit. It would not basically decide to bank some extra charge from the, you know, from the regular electricity grid to tide us over in case, you know, we lost power, we were off, you know, we had issues for longer periods of time. There was no way that these batteries could ever be charged from the main grid. It could only come from the solar equipment. The IRS said, look, it's not a problem that this is a later year. It's not a problem that these don't generate electricity. But here's the caveat. It is very important that the only place that can charge these batteries has to be the solar equipment itself. If that is not the case, the IRS makes it pretty clear in this ruling that they would not have issued the ruling if that had not been the fact pattern. So if you have a client who is looking at doing something like this, it apparently, per this ruling, is going to be fairly important to assure that there are systems in place to make sure they can't just use this whole house battery as some sort of backup storage device. Let's say, you know, we're expecting a problem. We've seen it with the hurricanes where maybe, you know, it might want to have a fully charged set of batteries before the storm hits and not, you know, and have stayed on grid, but, you know, but charged it up from the grid if it was short, rather than waiting till we lose power entirely and then have to live off the solar and hope the battery stays put. Well, you can't really have that this way. And if a client wants to be able to do that or have that option, then the question becomes, you don't really have, now I realize this is just a private letter ruling, and theoretically it doesn't apply to anybody except the entity, the person that got it. But in reality, we know that it's going to be used for marketing purposes, but the comfort level you have from this letter goes away to the extent you have comfort if you do not meet that key criteria. The ruling makes it very clear that criteria needs to be met. Next up is a pair of court cases, and actually one of them comes from last year and only became interesting to us because this year we had the same facts in front of a different court and we got a different ruling. The two cases, the first case is a case of Perkins versus Commissioner from the United States District Court for the Western District of New York, case number 1:16-CV-00495. That opinion was issued on August the 4th, 2017. And then we have the opinion issued this week, Perkins versus Commissioner, a public tax court decision, 150 TC number 6, issued on the 1st of March. What happened in this case was we have a member of the Seneca Nation who basically made an agreement with the council that she would be able to withdraw, to basically take gravel from land that was controlled by the Seneca Nation. And she had this right for a few years. And then what she was doing, obviously, is there's this market for gravel, so she's selling this gravel. She essentially removed the gravel from the land. That gave her an inventory of gravel, which she sold. She continued to sell this gravel even after she lost the right to take it from the land, basically because she had the inventory. Now, she took the position that there were two treaties with the Seneca Nation that exempted the income from tax. And these treaties are kind of interesting, and they go back quite a ways, as you might guess. The first treaty has a term that said it would acknowledge all land within the boundaries to be property of the Seneca Nation. The United States will never claim the same, nor disturb the Seneca Nation, nor any of the six nations or their Indian friends residing therein and united with them in the free use and enjoyment thereof of the land. Now, that's the first one. She said, well, what that meant was that any member of the Seneca Nation should be able to exclude from income any income generated by the land. And her position was, well, this gravel was part of the land, so therefore the income from selling the gravel would be exempt because the United States government had agreed never to interfere with the free use and enjoyment of the land. Now, the other one that came up was a second treaty, this one in 1842, that said the parties to this compact mutually agree to solicit the influence of the government of the United States to protect such of the land of the Seneca Indians within the state of New York as may from time to time remain in their possession from all taxes and assessments for roads, highways, or any other purpose until such land shall be sold and conveyed by said Indians and the possession thereof shall have been relinquished by them. Now, she said, well, there again, it said we're going to be free of all taxes. Well, if we're going to be free of taxes, then essentially, you know, my selling the gravel should not be taxable. There's an interesting quirk here because we're a number of years in question because she didn't file returns for a number of years. And 2010, which was the first year in question, they paid the tax and then they sued for a refund in United States District Court. Well, what happened in that case was ultimately the United States District Court agreed that these two provisions, these two treaties, effectively exempted the sale of gravel from tax. Now, the IRS had tried to argue the first treaty only applied to exempting, you know, free use of the land was only provided to the Seneca Nation as a, you know, unit. But the district court said, wait, it said the nation and its Indian friends. And what they said was, well, members of the Seneca Nation would be such Indian friends. And for that reason, you know, the exemption should apply to them as well. Okay, now that we'll find out later, the tax court doesn't buy that argument. They'll change it a little differently. Secondly, the court said the 1842 treaty, you know, also explicitly says that any income, that the land shall be free from tax, and that obviously this gravel came from the land, so there should be no tax. So the U.S. District Court agreed and found for, and essentially said there was an actionable crime. Now, this was a ruling on a motion to dismiss, so we don't really find whether or not, you know, she managed to cover the claim, because she has to prove she was a member of the tribe. She has to prove all the things, you know, that need to be proved for this case. And of course, the income came from the gravel and all those sorts of things. But they found, though, that there was definitely a claim based on that. Now, later years, they didn't pay the tax. So they, you know, they went to tax court. And the tax court found just the opposite. First, the tax court found that that first treaty, they said, did not confer any rights upon the individual members of the Seneca Nation. They said that concept of, quote unquote, their Indian friends was to allow them to deal with admitting members of other tribes. And also the court discovered, well, maybe thinking about the history of this, that was to prevent the U.S. government from attempting to argue that members of other tribes who moved on to Seneca land were actually settlers, right? Which had some issues. There's where they transferred land, you know, outside the reservation. There's all kinds of rules. So in any way, shape, or form, that was kind of, you know, that was interpreted, meaning it only went that way. The court pointed out the tax court had multiple times ruled that this particular treaty only affects the Seneca Nation as a whole, has no impact on the individuals. On the 1842 treaty, well, there they had a couple of issues there. They held that generally this only dealt with real estate taxes. They also found that it had no influence on taking like the dirt from the land. That, you know, once the dirt was removed from the land, they said it was no longer real property. They said it was the same as if you take a building off land. While that building's not part of land, it's not real property, but personal property. They said, therefore, there was no exclusion there. They disallowed the exemption. The interesting aside, of course, is that now we have two diametrically opposed results. Assuming the parties appeal these cases, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals would be the party that would have to decide which way this goes. For those of us in the rest of the country and who are not and who don't have members of the Seneca Nation who are, you know, selling gravel as clients, and that's probably most people, including those who have members of the Seneca Nation as clients. That's probably most of their clients aren't selling gravel either. What it does indicate, though, is how crucial it is, this whole selection of venue when they talk about tax cases. Also, now, since we're not attorneys, those are CPAs here, maybe some of you listening are, and fine, you can deal with that. But those of us who are CPAs, we have to remember that there's reasons why, just because, let's say, a district court case comes down one way, that doesn't mean that you can assume the tax court will go with your client. It also does, you know, we have to be careful reading these cases to understand how broadly they would apply. In this particular case, the fact is a tax court published opinion means that clearly outside the Second Circuit, even if this was overturned, we would have to expect the tax court to come to a similar conclusion involving similar treaties in other portions of the country. Next up, we got a couple of things for the remainder of today. We're going to talk about a couple of promises that were made by the IRS or by the Treasury Secretary, which the IRS fulfilled this week. The first one was there was a promise made that the IRS was going to issue a brand new set of rules that would stop what had been perceived as an end run around the carried interest rules that were part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Notice 2018-8, issued on March 1st of 2018, deals with this issue. When testifying before the Senate Finance Committee a couple of weeks ago, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin promised that the IRS was going to issue guidance within 2 weeks that would not allow S corporations to be used to evade the carried interest rules found in Section 1061 of the code. Now, the carried interest rules, let's talk about what those said. 1061, remember, there was a lot of fight over carried interest, and what was in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was a an item meant to somewhat reduce the benefit of a carried interest. It clearly doesn't get rid of it entirely. But if you're covered by this rule, that is, you receive a partnership interest in a partnership that's primarily an investment partnership, and you receive a profits interest in exchange for your services, that this, therefore, when we talk about the income passing through to you from the partnership, you are required to treat the long-term capital gain test becomes not whether the asset was held 1 year by the partnership, but whether the asset was held for 3 years. So therefore, many, many fewer assets will qualify for long-term capital gain treatment. You know, either the fund's got to hold it for 3 years. Most likely that's not going to work well because the other investors, you know, you're not, you know, the other investors not going to say, yeah, we'll accept the risk of holding this asset for 2 more years just so you get long-term capital gain treatment. Probably won't work so well. But an interesting aside was there is a provision in this law in section 1061, if you go to C4, and it tells us that this particular provision will not apply to any interest in a partnership directly or indirectly held by a corporation. Congress didn't specify it had to be a C corp. So what's happened in the interim is a lot of money managers have ended up going to Delaware, forming brand new S corporations, and of course transferring their partnership interest to the S corporation. Now the partnership interest is held by an S corporation, which is 100% owned by the money manager. The S corporation, they're going to say, therefore, that is not subject to 1061's rules, so that'll get a 1 year capital gain. Then the S corporation, of course, just passes that straight through to its shareholder on a new K-1. And on that K-1, it'll be just standard long-term capital gain treatment. Voila, we have totally evaded 1061. The Treasury Secretary said, well, that's clearly not what Congress meant. I think almost everybody agrees that is not what Congress meant. He said, so we're going to issue guidance that will clarify that you can't do that. And notice 2018-8 was issued to basically meet that promise. And what that notice says is very simple. I mean, there's a lot of text talking about the history of this and talking about all the issues and talking about other pieces of it. But as a practical matter, there's really only about one sentence that matters. And that sentence tells you that the IRS will issue regulations that will restrict this treatment to C corporations only. So the exemption shall only be issued for C corporations. We're not going to allow an S corporation. If an S corporation holds the interest in the partnership, the S corporation will still be subject to the carried interest rules. Well, that's all well and good, except the law is the law. And the law says corporation, never specified. Is there enough wiggle room in this law to allow the IRS to write a regulation that says that? Certainly, we will expect a lot of those people who set up these S corporations in Delaware, many of whom have some big tax numbers that will be involved, are likely to challenge any such regulation. So don't be surprised to see it challenged. Also, as one author pointed out this week in an article I was reading, and I should say it was actually a quote from somebody who what the author was quoting, noted that there's really no downside for somebody creating the S corporation and putting the partnership interest in there. In essence, you can't be much worse off. It's sure there are some circumstances. Maybe you hurt yourself by moving it to the S corp, but in most cases you won't. And the theory being that, and if this thing works, then you've got yourself a nice big tax break. Some would suspect that Congress may decide to try to short circuit that by including something about this in a technical corrections bill. Now we'll have to see it. It's kind of interesting. I have gotten the feeling that Congress doesn't want to try to go back into this because of concerns that if you open this back up, it may be opened back up for other issues. This was a very, very difficult compromise to come up with. And there's obviously a lot of people not happy with it. And that if it comes back open, that's just a can of worms they prefer to avoid. But I suspect if they don't go back in and fix the problem, you may very well find at least some courts going to say that, you know, IRS, that's not at all, shall we say, unclear in the law. There's no ambiguity there. A corporation is a corporation. In fact, we even have a code section that tells us the S corporation rules, the C corp rules apply to S corps unless it clearly, you know, unless it's clearly inconsistent with S treatment. And I have my doubts about a court, you know, at least one court's going to probably find this not clearly inconsistent. So in any event, interesting aside, if you have clients that have carried interest and they have gone the S route, you know, you want to warn them that this is there. Push comes to shove next year when we try to do returns and the question becomes reporting positions. Just be aware, it's probably going to be an A275 position if you do take the position that this is a one-year holding period, because by then expect to be contrary to a regulation, and that would be a problem. Now, the Treasury Secretary made another promise while they're on Capitol Hill talking to the Senate Finance Committee. He said the IRS would be getting that W-4 withholding calculator out at that point within a week. Didn't really meet that requirement, but it wasn't that short. On February 28th, the IRS issued a brand new W-4 withholding calculator online on their website, as well as issuing a brand new 2018 Form W-4. The new calculator was issued, not surprisingly, to reflect the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act's changes in the law. So, you know, we've made some changes. They've changed the form. They've changed the layout. The calculator worked through that. We also issued at the same time a revised 2018 Form W-4 is out there. So you can get the paper Form W-4. You can take a look at that. People can fill that in. Certainly, if you're in a payroll department, you want to get the revised 2018 W-4. You want to make sure your employees are using that and not the older version. Now, there are some issues, though. This calculator, it works pretty well if you have a taxpayer that has just W-2 wages, you know, basically takes the standard deduction. It'll probably work pretty well. The IRS, though, does specifically warn that there are a number of taxpayers that, you know, can't really rely on the calculator. It says, in fact, there's an important note they put on their website regarding the calculator, stating that people with more complex tax situations need to use the instructions in Publication 505, Tax Withholding That's Made Tax. Now, if you go try to do that right now, you'll discover that hasn't been released yet. In fact, the IRS website tells us that they expect to have that updated in, quote, early spring. Well, early spring is somewhere in the late part of this month is when that starts, and obviously that would continue well into April. So what they're saying is don't expect it the next day or two, but we should see Pub File 505 come up, right? And the people who need to worry about that are those who owe self-employment tax, AMT, the tax on unearned incomes of dependents or certain other taxes, and people with long-term capital gains or qualified dividends. I think for most of us listening to this broadcast, that's like 99% of our clients are in that list. But for us, to be honest, most of us probably know that if we're going to do any of these, if we ever get dragged into doing a W-4 calculation for a client, we sometimes do, we're probably going to go look at our tax projection software and work from there. Those of you using BNA's income tax spreadsheet, that's what we use here at my office. They have a W-4 calculator that actually works pretty well. The client can tell you year to date, what they've taken out. They can give, you know, run the projections. And what it does obviously is backs into the number of allowances you want to claim to get the right withholding. So at the end of the year, what we have paid in is going to be approximately what we think we're going to owe. So obviously those things are ready to go. However, because this is out and because it's getting publicity, I would not be surprised to find that some of you are going to have clients calling right now asking specifically, well, what should I put on the W-4? My payroll department just gave me a 2018 form. They claim it's new and I should take a look at it and talk to my tax advisor. Yeah, be ready for those calls. I realize this is probably not the best time to start getting such calls. It's just as you start having to do tons of work on other tax returns. But, you know, it is the sort of thing that happens when we have a major change in law. And certainly, some people have to be concerned about what their withholding exemptions, or their, should say, withholding allowances. Don't want to call them exemptions. I know we always used to, but, you know, they're allowances because we all know exemptions really aren't going to be there next year. Or I should say for this year, actually, it's 2018's return. So, you know, be ready for those calls. Be ready to work with the clients. Be ready to try to help them get their W-4s in play, because now the brand new W-4 is out. As always, we couldn't do this without the state societies that we work with, who allow us, you know, who basically are the people that are basically, you know, paying the paycheck, shall we say, for me, so I can be doing, you know, these presentations and I can record this thing for you. So make sure you take a look when we come up here at the end of tax season. I know you all start looking for that. Check your state society courses. As I said, we've been working on courses that are dealing specifically with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. We've been updating our courses, you know, in the other, in the major subject areas to make sure that we talk specifically about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and what's happening. All of that guidance to really help you implement this new law, which is, you know, fairly significant change, is all being developed at this point. It's going to be in your state society catalogs. Be sure to check those out when they come out here. And most state societies, some posted actually during tax season, you take a look at it. A lot of them, though, you know, understand that you probably aren't going to look at that website till after April the 15th, or I should say this year, you know, April the 17th. So, you know, they'll have it up around then. Just be sure to check there. We're certainly working on those and getting ready to present this year in all of the neat areas impacted by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 5th, 2018. Be sure to catch our daily updates, or I should say updates when things happen, on currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You also can send any questions or comments to edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'm on Twitter, and you can, my handle there is @edzollers. I also follow discussions on the subreddit at Reddit, www.reddit.com/r/taxpros. You can pick me up there if you have any quick questions. You can probably find me hanging around that place. Otherwise, come back here next week. We're not seeing lots of developments because the IRS basically is right now, I'm sure, thoroughly concentrating on Tax Cuts and Jobs Act guidance. When that comes out, though, expect it to come out very rapidly and messy and have a lot of things happening. So we're expecting things to start happening, but it's probably going to take a little while. So until then, take care. Have fun doing the tax work you're going to be doing this week. And we'll see you all back here a week from now on Current Federal Tax Developments.